My name is Sally Kirkendall, and I am program evaluator. Can I do it with this?
Yes.
Okay.
You should be able to do the math quick.
Okay. I'm program evaluator for community-based programs. So my area of expertise is not necessarily domestic violence. I work in bullying prevention and gun carrying and all kinds of things. But for this project, I worked with Institute for Safe Families, which is located in Philadelphia, and Ann Adelist Estrin, who's works with the National Resource Center for Children and Families of the Incarcerated. Oops, wrong way. Background on child maltreatment, which you just had, so I'll just do a quick overview. About 1 out of 100 to 1 out of 5 children meet the criteria for child maltreatment. It really depends on how you define maltreatment and what communities you're looking at. The highest risk populations, if we have a rate of 10.3 per 1,000, the highest rate populations are infants, 21.7, because you're talking about new parents struggling with parenting. Toddlers, 11.7 to 12.9 per 1,000, and African American, 16.6 per 1,000. In 2008, 1,740 children died from maltreatment. Infants and toddlers accounted for 80% of these deaths. And a major risk factor for child maltreatment is living in a home where there's intimate partner violence. The overlap is about 50%. 30 to 60% of maltreated children live in families with IPV. And we've done quite a bit of work on children's exposure to domestic violence. And the estimates are 3.3 to 17.8 million children in the U.S. witness intimate partner violence annually. And some of the people that I work with would argue that witnessing domestic violence, witnessing intimate partner violence, is child maltreatment. Are you guys familiar with the ACEs study, Adverse Childhood Experiences Study? Okay, so I don't need to tell you much about that, other than we know that one of the adverse childhood experiences is witnessing domestic violence. And we know that that does eventually cause earlier death. The problems associated with childhood exposure is all kinds of behavioral, developmental, hyperactivity, fear, anxiety, and of course problems with the parent-child bonding. It is where the child begins to act like the parent. And I've noticed, or some of the physicians tell me that they'll come into the child and parent will come into the office, and the child is answering the questions, the child is acting as the parent, usually protecting the mom, trying to protect the mom. There are those who believe that there's neurological changes because of the high cortisol and ACTH and epinephrine levels, and that those might actually cause permanent neurological changes, although that is questionable. But the fight, flight, the reactions can become hardwired into the brain, and you may see these later in life. The long-term effects of children's exposure: depression, suicide, substance abuse, smoking with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, heart disease. Multiple sexual partners, they really have a lot of high-risk behaviors, of course, sexually transmitted diseases, unintended pregnancies, and, of course, there is the cycle where it continues with the next generation. When I looked back, when Institute for Safe Families contacted me and said, we want to do this program, I went back to the literature, and I found that there were 6 main major types of child abuse prevention programs. They're home visiting, parenting programs, family preservation services, which would be like resources, family-focused interventions, social support, and multimodal, which is a combination of the above. So the CHANCE program is the program that I was evaluating, and the curriculum was developed by Ann Adelist Estrin. The trainings were delivered in 2 early childhood education centers. And the idea was that if we train teachers of toddlers and preschool children, the ones that are those highest risk, we train teachers to recognize the behaviors among children, then we might be able to get these families into care and into services before something happens in the home where Child Protective Services has to intervene. And the way, what the group believed was that, and the early childhood education providers supported this, is when you have children who are exposed to violence in the home, and their preschools and toddlers, they'll go into the daycare centers and they'll act it out. You will see, you know, toddlers or preschool children, you know, acting out the violence in the home. There was one situation that teachers explained where you had one little girl and she was fighting with another little girl because she wanted the boy to be, or the young man, child to be her baby's daddy, and it was just, the teacher said it's unbelievable some of the things that they saw. So by recognizing this early, by recognizing the signs and knowing which resources to refer the families to, then we hope to reduce some of the children's exposure to domestic violence. In addition to the program, they had public awareness campaigns. So some of the posters that you've seen on the slides were posted in the early childhood education centers. And then we had local service providers come in, talk to the teachers, and kind of facilitate referrals so that the teachers had a face, a name of someone to call rather than just calling this, you know, huge resource. And then the centers, the early childhood education centers, actually developed policies for children who were exposed to domestic violence in terms of what they would do if there were signs, who it would be reported to, and then the next steps. So the goal of the project was to empower the ECE community to respond to family violence in a safe and effective manner. These were the four modules. The first module was just an overview of domestic violence in America. The second module was looking at the response, the effects of domestic violence on young children. The third module was what early childhood education staff could do, because daycares provide a stable environment where there is not a stable environment at home. So sometimes the daycare centers were the places where the children felt that it was comfortable, they were most comfortable acting out, because they couldn't act out at home because it was too much of a nightmare. And then the fourth one was to help them create programs, policies, and procedures for responding and to connect the family with agencies. We did hand select centers. We wanted centers who were able to, you know, develop policies and implement the policies. And so we said that they had to have at least one star in the Keystone Stars program. The Keystone Stars program is really just like almost like an accreditation program for daycare centers. And then at least 33% of the families needed to be receiving child care subsidy. And I think all of the families actually were receiving child care subsidy in both centers. The actual census data for the areas that were served, you can see there was a high African American population, low educational level, high school diploma or higher was about 70 to 74%. So that's actually not too bad in consideration of some areas. Most of the children were from family incomes, as I said, below the median in the U.S. For the evaluation, I used mixed methods, impact and outcome. We used a parent survey. We surveyed the teachers. We got feedback from key stakeholders in the community, some of those resources that we connected the teachers with, and then we used Child Protective Service reports. The program author, that was Anne, did all of the training, so we didn't have to worry too much about fidelity. Since she wrote the program, hopefully she was, you know, faithful to her own program. We had really good attendance, and part of that was because the daycare centers worked well in terms of getting their teachers to the program and making sure that this was a priority. We had very dedicated leaders in each center. The needs assessment. Now, for the first column there, where I have CEDV, that's childhood exposure to domestic violence of the parent or guardian, this was a survey that went to the parents and it was to find out if they were exposed to childhood to domestic violence as a child. And you can see that at pretest, 47.5% said that they were exposed to pushing, grabbing, slapping, or having something thrown at their parent. And then at post-test, 60%. Now, we don't think the numbers actually went up. We think that what happened was there was increased awareness, so therefore we had increased reporting. And that was, you know, fairly consistent for some of them. But then what we were more interested in was the victimization of the parent or guardian. So we asked them if they were exposed as a child, and then we asked them if they had been victimized within the past couple of months. And you can see that there was less victimization. For some reason, some of our numbers at the interim were actually better than the numbers at post. And the only thing I can say is that we did have some new parents coming in, so maybe that influenced the post-test numbers, because there were a lot of changes in state regulations and reimbursement and stuff during this. Sure. Correct, because we did this, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned, it was a 2-year program. So some of the parents left, but we did try to train, have training for most of the parents that had come in. We did the post in the spring, so the parents should have, any parents in the spring should have had training throughout the year, or have been exposed to the posters and, you know, sessions. But that's not to say that all of them were. So our numbers.
They may have had a different baseline level of some of these things.
Yes. Parent or guardian changes. And I really want to point out, these were just questions that we asked on the survey, but the one that I think is really interesting is that at the end of the program, 90% of the parents felt that the ECE environment was an appropriate place to address child maltreatment. So it says that they were receptive to the messages that they were getting from the public service announcements and from the teachers. And then one thing I found really interesting was that fewer felt comfortable offering resources to victims, but more of them felt comfortable offering resources to perpetrators. And that could be because part of the program was to teach children to teach teachers and parents that the perpetrators needed help as well. These are just the changes in the children's exposure. We used these are the things that we include when we talk about how we define children's exposure to domestic violence, and you can see that the greatest change was that fewer children joined in the fighting and fewer children were physically hurt during the fighting. Okay. One of the writing comments from parents is they should know that we asked them what they thought needed to be done, and parent wrote in they should know it's okay to ask for help. Help should be offered at places such as doctor's office, WIC offices, public assistance, and other places that people would feel comfortable going, which Philadelphia is working on that. Told you about the 90% increase. Yeah, I think I covered all of these. Okay. And then changes in the ECE provider knowledge. Since this was a program for ECE providers, a significantly higher number of the ECE providers said that they could recognize the signs of distress in young children and that they knew at least 3 resources for help for victims of domestic violence. This was a really interesting story case. One of the ECE center directors said that she thought that there was a child who was being exposed to domestic violence in the household. She was struggling with how to approach the family about the issue, but she knew, you know, from the background that there was something that needed to be done. The father came in, the child was displaying anger, difficult behavior, and the The director actually reported it to the parents. The father came in very angry one day, and she just responded very calmly, children model what they see at home. And it went, got through to him. And the father sought help for his behavior, and they provided a slower transition for the child so that they could support the child going into the next pre-K group. So they were able to address some of the issues and get resources for both the child and the father. So what we found was that the providers demonstrated a strong knowledge of children's exposure to domestic violence at pre-test. So a lot of the teachers already knew it. But again, we helped them to get help with the resources. And might have had some selection bias with the fact that we handpicked our groups. When I looked at Child Protective Service reports for the two zip codes that were the participating centers were, and we saw that there was a 17.8% decrease. Unfortunately, other regions of the city showed a 29% decline. So we can't quite claim that 18% decrease. Study limitations, it was only two centers. We're not sure. The good baseline knowledge of the problem before we started kind of threw the numbers off, and then the increased reporting, the increased awareness with increased reporting kind of confounds the results. We're not sure how sustainable the program is after Institute for Safe Families and Ann Adelaide Estrin were no longer there to support, but we do know there's a sad lack of resources in these communities. So the CHANCE program appeared to work to improve knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors, and the parents and guardians, as well as the providers, felt that the early childhood education environment was a good place, an appropriate place to address DV.